Everybody can please be seated. I'm honored to welcome all of you to the Reagan Library. I'm Gene Meyer, president of the Federalist Society, and we're honored to be conducting this event on Ed Meese's legacy as the 75th Attorney General of the United States. As befits the man, this conference is designed to be more about his ideas, and that's what most of the discussion is going to be about. To me, his legacy has always been first and foremost bringing the constitutional text back into the discussion of constitutional law, but our speakers will be able to go far deeper than that. This year, the Federalist Society is marking its 25th anniversary, culminating with our convention this November. We want to celebrate this anniversary, but we want primarily for it to be use it as a way to build the next generation of those committed to advancing limited government and the rule of law. This event is part of that in two ways. First, it's our inaugural Western Conference, and we plan to make this an annual event every year somewhere on the West Coast. And second, and even more appropriately, the Reagan administration in general, and Attorney General Meese in particular, were critical to the nascent Federalist Society. As we do celebrate our 25th year, it's only right to acknowledge that there probably would be no celebration without Ed Meese and all he has done for this organization. This conference was a brainchild in part of Professor Gail Harriott, who helped develop and structure it. The opening panel, you all have the program in front of you. The opening panel is going to be on the Meese Justice Department and its accomplishments and its relevance to things today. We have a luncheon talk by Theodore Olson. Gail Harriott will do an interview with General Meese, and we'll conclude with a panel on originalism. To moderate the first panel, I'm going to announce the one change I know of and turn you over to our moderator. Michael Yeoman was going to be the moderator, but the California freeways got him, and I am not letting him go for the moment. So substituting for him, we have, and are very fortunate to have, the Honorable John Harrington, who was Secretary of Energy in the Reagan administration, and I really appreciate the pinch hitting, and I'll turn it over to John.
Thank you, Gene. And you got a lot of distinguished people here today in the audience, and I'm sure at some point they'll introduce them all. But it's really fun to look out and see some faces I haven't seen in years. And we have people that have gotten to very distinguished positions. But I want you to remember what they were when the whole Reagan movement started. Dermot O'Sandlin in Portland, Oregon in 1980, now a Ninth Circuit judge, but he handled the first salmon of the year as it was handed to President Reagan. And Harvey Cook, where are you, Harvey? 1968, he was in, there he is, New Orleans fighting for Ronald Reagan. 68, he's one of the few lawyers in New Orleans that was willing to stand up and oppose President Nixon in favor of Ronald Reagan. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce this panel today. And this is, in fact, the honoring of Ed Meese. But more than that, it's honoring the Meese Justice Department. And I would venture to say I'm probably the only person in this room that was a client of that Justice Department. We were a user of their services. And it was fun. The Energy Department was probably sued, Ed, 7 to 10 times a day somewhere in the United States. And this was a can-do group of people, and you're going to hear from them today. It wasn't the Janet Reno-Bill Clinton relationship where there were firewalls and there were, you couldn't find probable cause to arrest Wenho Lee. We had our Wenho Lees in the National Laboratory. But when we called the Justice Department of Ed Meese, they were can-do people, and they did everything they could to represent the people in the government and the people's interest. And you're going to hear more of that today. So we're going to start first with our first speaker, and I'm going to go down the list, the same ones. And I'm not going to say a lot about them because you've read it all in the program. But I'm going to start with the Honorable Ken Cribb, who was the right-hand man of Ed Meese in the White House when Ed sat in the old Henry Kissinger office in the corner and was counselor to the president. And Ken was intimately involved with Ed's policy initiatives, and handled all the day-to-day things that went on. So, Ken, would you step up and be recognized?
Thank you, John. John and I went and met the brand-new Attorney General when he was just getting into Washington in 1981 to begin the administration, and we were meeting each other for the first time. So I was there because the transition, Justice Transition, had reported through me, and John was there because he was arranging bills, all of Bill Smith's arrangements. And so I asked Ed Meese to tell me something about John Harrington. It says, all you have to know about John Harrington is he'd walk through a brick wall for Ronald Reagan. So it's a privilege to be introduced by my old friend. I worked with Ed Meese for 9 years, from the 1980 campaign through the end of the second term. And I'd like to use that vantage to provide two pieces of our larger consideration of the Meese Justice Department. First, I'll describe what I observed as the impact of Ed's White House operation on justice issues. And second, I'll use that vantage as my vantage as head of Ed's transition team when he was appointed Attorney General to tell you what we set out to accomplish and how we organized to do so. In other words, what I hope to do is give a little overview so that when my colleagues provide the substance of their very considerable contributions, there's a little bit of a framework there. Ed never regarded himself as an independent operator with his own policy agenda. He understood that all of our powerful colleagues in the executive branch, there was only one elected by the citizens to act on their behalf, and that was, of course, Ronald Reagan himself. As Article 2 sets out, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. So Ed's goal was to convert into successful policies President Reagan's strongly held and carefully considered convictions concerning the proper role of government under the Constitution. And I would summarize those convictions as three aspects of the preservation of freedom. One, the text of the Constitution must be strictly followed, since it is the only set of fundamental rules that a free people has consented to through the ratification process. Two, the Constitution secures the blessings of liberty by carefully limiting the scope of government authority over the people at home. And three, the common defense must be energetically undertaken to protect the people's freedom from foreign domination. As to the constitutional fidelity aspect of that, here are President Reagan's own words. The role the framers assigned to judges in our system was to interpret the Constitution and lesser laws, not to make them. It was to protect the integrity of the Constitution, not to add or subtract from it, and certainly not to rewrite it. For as the framers knew, unless judges are bound by the text of the Constitution, we will in fact no longer have a government of laws, but of men and women who are judges. And if that happens, the words of the documents that we think govern us will be just masks for the personal and arbitrary rule of a small elite. None of our originalist philosophers and experts have said it better. And the reason I wanted to give you that direct quote was I want you to understand that Ronald Reagan himself had a serious and consequential theory of the Constitution. Ed Meese saw his role as putting that theory into practice throughout the Reagan administration and then in 1985 with particularity at the Justice Department itself. It began in the 1980 campaign when the General Counsel's office, which reported to Ed Meese, put out papers on the proper approach to judicial selection. And when the candidate himself repeatedly made limits on government power his constant theme, President Reagan's victory allowed him to claim a mandate for these explicit articulations of his philosophy of government. Next, Ed Meese was director of the 1980 transition, and the Department of Justice team, of course, was part of that. Lawrence Smith and I worked on that one, and we made sure that the transition team was populated by lawyers who agreed with the president's philosophy. The team mapped out plans that then Attorney General Bill Smith embraced with enthusiasm, and Bill in turn brought with him Ken Starr and Ted Olson and Lois Harrington and Brad Reynolds and others who brought distinction and energy to the Reagan legal agenda. Meanwhile, back at the White House, Ed devised the Cabinet Council on Legal Policy, chaired by Bill Smith, to bring our principal legal policy officers together every few weeks in an unprecedented coordination of administration-wide legal policy. One of the most important early fruits of all this work was the elevation of judicial selection to the top of the agenda. We all had a sense of urgency about that, because Republican presidents from Eisenhower forward had never managed to consistently select judges who would be faithful to the text of the Constitution. So that by the end of the Nixon and Ford presidencies, there was only one Democrat, Thurgood Marshall, in the liberal majority of the Burger Court. The other Democrat, Byron White, usually sided with the dissenters. Activist Justice William Brennan had been appointed by President Eisenhower, Harry Blackmun and Lewis Powell by President Nixon, and John Paul Stevens by President Ford. A careful vetting process was established at the Justice Department, which Justice Stephen Markman will discuss shortly, and ended with final recommendations to the President made sitting around the table in the Roosevelt Room just steps away from the Oval Office. And then after the President's decision, he himself would telephone personally each and every judicial nominee as a way of underscoring his high expectation for a return to constitutional fidelity. This also was unprecedented. That elevation to the top of the administration was a very important reform. In earlier Republican presidencies had treated this as an ABA politician perk. Or some other form of patronage is how Warren got on the court, for example. Another early reform was improving the actual predictability of judicial selection by taking advantage of the scholarship of Robert Bork and others writing in the 1970s on the role of the judge. Before this intellectual analysis was available, all our judge pickers were slogans, judicial restraint. Quote, would you legislate from the bench? Those kinds of things, which, of course, everyone knows the answer to if you want a judgeship. So, with an actual analysis, Siebel described what could be done to weed out the activists of both the left and the right. So by the time Ed was nominated to be Attorney General in 1984, the Democrats were using such opportunities to attack and delay President Reagan's agenda. And Ed's hearings were obstructed for just about a year. In the meantime, Bill Smith was so clearly on his way back to California that many of his lieutenants moved on in the interim. The downside was that we lost a lot of great talent. The upside was that the entire civil side of the Justice Department could be remade for the specific purpose of implementing the new Attorney General's priorities. So the first job of the transition team was to assemble the team. And I'm afraid that we came close to draining the rest of the administration of talent, along with the great brains trust that was already in place at Justice, including many of our presenters during the day today. And that brains trust really became the engine of policy development for the entire administration in the second term, and widely acknowledged so as such within the administration at the time. That brains trust, led by the Attorney General, had an actual formal outlet to influence the policy of the other cabinet departments, because when Ed was named Attorney General, he was also named the chairman of the Domestic Policy Council. All the domestic policy councils collapsed into one. And Ed chaired that. It was staffed at the Justice Department, which gave this powerful bank of talent that Ed assembled direct purchase on the other departments of government. The nascent Federalist Society was key to this. Although it had just been formed in 1982 and although its members were still very young, they were the brilliant young lawyers who staffed all of the special assistant positions, the deputy positions, many of them throughout the department. It was an invaluable source of talent. Of course, now they could staff the senior positions and do quite easily because of the natural maturation of the work of the Federalist Society. I'm not giving you this as mere history. Attention to the appointment power is a but-for condition of consequential policymaking. People are policy. So it's quite important what occurred in that. But for that careful attention to personnel and the detail with which it was approached, nothing would have been possible. The second task of the transition, of course, was to plan the agenda. Well, this had been quietly underway for the year that I mentioned. Detailed briefing books had been prepared and personal briefings had been conducted for the nominee as to every major division of the project. But the new team, the newly assembled Meese lieutenants, needed to be seized of all that work and had to map out the practical ways and means to accomplish it. So I remember Ed Foner said, this is great news, all the talent that you all are bringing in the Justice Department. What can we do? How can Heritage help? I said, well, would you hold a retreat for us? Would you sponsor a retreat? And you had not been sworn in yet, Ed, so it was not proper for you to be there. And that was just as well, because this was a working session, ways and means. And we went off to the mountains of Virginia and for the first time began our work together as Ed's lieutenants and mapping out, as I say, the ways and means. So there were a number of recommendations we made at that time. There had been no confirmed head of the Office of Legal Policy for some months, and the judicial selection process had become rusty. So judicial selection was taken into the Attorney General's own office to get it spinning like a top. And then when Steve Bartman came on board and put his team together, it was redelegated back to the Office of Legal Policy. Now, that's just an indication of how little chance we were taking with the question of judicial selection. Second, a litigation strategy group consisting of the heads of the major litigating divisions was formed to ensure that a consistent theory of the law was presented in all the briefs of the United States. That's hard to do. I mean, it's quite typical that you're out for victory and you argue what you have to argue to get the victory. But that had to stop. That had to stop in place of a consistent theory of the Constitution on the great structural doctrines like federalism, separation of powers, or jurisdiction, the case and controversy limit on the judiciary, on the political question doctrine, on remedies that punished conduct in criminal cases, that punished misconduct rather than excluded probative evidence. And it required discipline, the discipline of citing with approval only those important cases that clarified doctrine, that advanced doctrine, not citing a bad precedent just because it helped you win in that instance, which was too often the practice. It's human nature. One does that, but it was necessary to stop doing it. And the discipline of opposing even the policies of your own administration when that's what the law required. An example would be Bosher v. Sinar, when we were very much in favor of the Graham-Rubman Act, but it had an offense against the separation of powers in it. And actually, we argued for its unconstitutionality in the court. There was a severability clause, and the law survived, and the offending provision was taken out. But, you know, it was rather remarkable that the Reagan administration would oppose its own policy on constitutional grounds, and the same with many redistricting cases when the Meese Justice Department were on opposite sides of the Republican Party in Virginia and Indiana and others because of our view of what the law required. Another recommendation was to create a standing research operation put in place to be ready for any Supreme Court vacancy. So these were a few of them. But as my colleagues discussed the substantive hits and misses of all these process measures, consider one of the lasting effects of that early work is the farm team that it created. At the beginning of our transition efforts, Ed cautioned me, said that he valued gray hair. Remember that, Ed? And I came back and said, Ed, there aren't enough gray-haired people that agree with us. And fortunately, it was a rebuttable presumption on his part. And so many of Ed's appointments to high office in the Department of Justice were relatively young intellectuals, and many that he recommended to the president for the lower courts were also young because that's where the talent was and that's where the people were that agreed with our philosophy. Suffice it to say that most of the figures on the long list for the recent Supreme Court vacancies served either in the Reagan Justice Department or were Reagan appointees to the bench or both, including both eventual nominees. Finally, Ed sought to focus the legal culture on the question of the proper role of the judge under the Constitution by inaugurating what has been called the Great Debate. The debate eventually included Justices Brennan and Stevens and Judge Bork and Ronald Reagan himself. By the way, the president never mentioned the word Constitution without mentioning the word text in the same sentence. But you'll recall some of the most prominent assertions of that debate on the part of Ed Meese. The Constitution was a written document whose words were debated at length, carefully chosen, and therefore the framers' handiwork may be presumed to convey an identifiable meaning. The Constitution contains the means of its own amendment in Article 5, so we may conclude the original meaning of its provisions control until amended according to the Article 5 process. The Constitution itself, by its own terms, is the supreme law of the land and not the body of constitutional decisions which have grown up around it. Can you believe the uproar that one caused? The executive and the Congress have no less a right and no less a duty to interpret the Constitution as does the judiciary, and the role of the judge is to issue a rule of decision in a case or controversy, and that rule of decision must interpret and apply law. Finally, the division of power against itself in the structure of the Constitution is its genius and the primary safeguard of our liberties. Therefore, the great structural doctrines of federalism and separation of powers must be revived. These fundamental principles of American law found hospitality at the Meese Justice Department at a time when the legal academic establishment had barred its doors. 20 years later, we see the results all around us as the proponents of the originalism have become legion and as its opponents define themselves in contradistinction to the originalist position. 3 decades from now, as the United States celebrates its first quarter millennium of the Constitution, a new generation of lovers of the law might hearken back to Ed Meese and the great debate about constitutional fidelity that occurred in the 1980s. And they may be able to say that it was a turning point in the course of American law. At this remove, we can't tell with certainty. But I believe that we can already be justly proud of the Herculean effort that Ed Meese has made on behalf of those blessings of liberty that our written Constitution secures. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Those were great remarks. And you truly were there at the center or the eye of the storm. I can see that this panel is going to become very legalistic and it's going to be an Ed Meese love-in. And before we go any farther, I think I want you to get some perspective on this. Meese and Company is two people. One of the smartest, most fun women I've ever known. The brains behind this man, Ursula Meese. Would you recognize her, please? I don't want his head to get too big today, although it'll be tempted. Our next speaker as we go along on this list of accomplishments is the Honorable Lois Haight, and as a full disclosure, my wife of 42 years, my partner, the only Federalist and conservative that's ever been named, I think, California Judge of the Year 2 years ago. And in this state, that's a big accomplishment.
Well, I've not been introduced by my husband before, but I expect you to look at me with Nancy Reagan eyes during this entire speech. My husband mentioned that we've seen some old friends, and there is a story I told before, but I get to tell it again. Because I went to a retreat, now a reunion not long ago, and it was a reunion of, I will tell you what high school it was, what year. But anyway, I called a friend of mine. I said, my God, Carol, everybody looks so old. Did you see how old everybody looked? She said, Lois, I'm going to send you a little story. It was a story of a woman that went to a dentist in her town, and she went to the dentist, and her other dentist had retired, so she thought she would try this new dentist, and she looked at the plaque, and oh, gee, as she walked in, she said, I used to know a guy by that name. Oh, I had kind of a crush on him in high school. He was the stud. I had such a crush, and out walks the dentist, and introduces himself, and he's kind of craggy and a little gray and a little old. And whew, she goes, introduces herself. She said, well, where are you from? He said, well, I'm from San Mateo. She said, oh, really? Well, I'm from San Mateo. Where did you go to school? He said, I went to San Mateo High. She said, I went to San Mateo High. What class were you in? He said, I was in the class of 1957. She said, I was in that class. He said, what did you teach? So I have humbly look around, and I think you all look great. I think you look terrific, and I'm really glad I didn't know, Ed, that you were looking for gray hair in the 80s, because I am never going gray. It doesn't matter if I'm 110. I'm not going gray. All right, I want to give just a short comments about things that I know mean a lot to Ed Meese, and he's done quite a job in this arena. I did have the opportunity to work for both attorney generals, and I was very fond of William French Smith. He was a wonderful, wise, lovely man, but he did not know crime. And it was just wonderful having Ed Meese come in as attorney general, because Ed Meese understood violent crime. He understood the effects it had in our society and what it did to innocent victims of crime. And he brought that issue with him. First of all, he brought this issue when he was laying these fundamental issues that he'd been thinking about for a long time when he was counselor to the president. He established the task force on violent crime, and then he established the task force on victims of crime. And Justice Nicholson here in the front row was a great participant in that and certainly educated us all. Justice Nicholson, by the way, we're just really lucky to have you on our bench in California. You ought to give him a lot of applause. But when Ed Meese established these task force, we looked around at the Department of Justice, what was going on in the criminal justice system, and we found a system that was out of balance. We found a system that was serving the lawyers and the judges and the defendants and was ignoring and mistreating and even blaming innocent victims of crime. And you've all heard those stories. You've heard these questions. Well, what were you doing out in the street at night, Mrs. Jones? Or why were you wearing that red dress, Mrs. Smith? Or the one that got me is, why did you answer your doorbell, Mr. X, when it rang? Like, why do we have doorbells? But there'd been an incident. Well, you know, one victim actually said, you know, blaming victims is like analyzing the cause of World War II and saying, well, what was Pearl Harbor doing in the middle of the Pacific anyway? But, you know, we had this insidious change in our national thinking. We had shifted the burden of the innocent citizen to stay out of harm's way rather than requiring, as every civilization must, that people don't break the law. We had shifted responsibility for crime for those who suffered, not those who did it. And it was time to put our criminal justice system in balance. And Ed Meese oversaw this in a myriad of ways. And let me just give you an idea of what was going on in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s when the Meese Justice Department started looking into this. And those that are in criminal law, you will understand. Those that have been victims of crime, you will certainly understand this. How many regions, how many states address some of these issues? There was only one state in the entire nation that allowed background checks on for employers to do on employees that work with children. Now, where do you think pedophiles, molesters hung out? Where they could work with children. There was only one region in the United States that had separate waiting rooms for victims and witnesses. That means when the victim is waiting to testify in trial, they're standing out there next to victim, you know, the defendant's brother killer Spike, while they're waiting to go in and testify. Certainly a breeding ground for a lot of intimidation and harassment. Only 8 states had any restitution for victims of crime. Now, you know, the basic tenet of civil law is to make the person whole. And it was just an outrage. What do you mean restitution for victims, people were talking about? Like they didn't lose anything? Victim input at sentencing. Only 8 regions allowed the victim to write anything to the judge. And only 3 regions in the United States allowed victims to speak at the time of sentencing. Now, I thought this was most egregious because I'd been almost held in contempt one time as a DA I was in Alameda County when I had come after a very nasty rape trial. We'd finally gotten a conviction. And when it came for sentencing, the judge ordered me out of the courtroom and the victim. And I said, Your Honor, who's more interested in this case than this victim? And he said, You are trying to pressure me out, or I'll hold you in contempt and hold her in contempt. Well, I thought I wouldn't mind going to jail and proving my point, but I'd hate to drag her along with me to jail. So things were really pretty rough for victims. And, you know, one of the cases that Ed Meese helped bring to the attention of the president in the Rose Garden ceremony was a woman that was mugged in the state of Maryland, and her purse was taken. It doesn't sound like a big deal. She was mugged. That's the judge. It was a plea bargain. The guy got a couple of weeks in jail and 6 months probation. Nobody bothered to find out that Elizabeth Montgomery was in a walker for the rest of her life, because when he mugged her, he lifted her up and slammed her on the ground when he took her purse, and she had to sell her home she'd lived in all her adult life because she was in the walker, and it was a home with stairs, and her bedroom was upstairs. Nobody bothered to find out at that time and in those times what the consequences of crime were on the victim. So when the judge is passing sentence, they could be informed and know what was going on, know what the effect of the crime was. Another area that was very important, because only two regions actually, allowed any notification for victims of crime that there was going to be a sentencing, that there were going to be continuances, that there was going to be a bail hearing. How important is it for a victim to know about a bail hearing? You know, when the guy says, I'll kill you if you ever report, you want to make sure the judge knows that. And one of the cases that Ed Meese was with the president in the Rose Garden was a case of a pharmacist out in Marin County named Elvis Regalia, who had a pharmacy in Marin County. And he'd been burglarized several times and been robbed several times. And every time he had to come down and cooperate with the criminal justice system, and cases would be continued, and the DA would come out and say, I'm sorry, it was continued, or he plea bargained and he'd go home, or it was continued to another day and he'd go home again. And each time, though, he had to close his pharmacy because by law you couldn't have a pharmacy open without the pharmacist. Finally, the last time he actually was held at gunpoint and hostage and came down and cooperated to find out it was plea bargained weeks before, he finally said, I give up, I quit. He said, I cannot afford to participate in the criminal justice system. In California, he became the pharmacist at San Quentin Prison. He said, I felt safer at San Quentin Prison, and I actually made more money in the long run because I didn't have to close my pharmacy. But that is a true story. I mean, it's how out of balance, how skewed we had become in a system that nobody had bothered to look at until Ed Meese created this task force on victims of crime. Just a couple of other things, return of victims' property. Only 4 regions in the whole United States had any kind of even policy for it. Like, whose property is it? And they couldn't get their property back. Protection from intimidation or harassment. There were only 4 legislative statutes in the United States in the early 80s that even looked at that issue. And finally, the issue that I think is very important. I'm very proud of Ed Meese and the Justice Department and the President for implementing this, what was victims' compensation. And, you know, the woman that really was instrumental in this, that participated in the Rose Garden ceremony with General Meese and the President, was a woman called Betty Jane Spencer in Indiana. And Betty Jane Spencer was in a farmhouse with her 4 sons when 4 hoodlums on a crime spree broke in. They put all 4 of Betty Jane's sons on the floor and shot them all in the back of the head with shotguns, and they all died. Betty Jane was wearing a wig from a recent operation. They shot her in the back of the head, and the carnage, they left her for dead. They thought they'd killed her. She survived. She came and met the president, and she said to the president, you know, I'm the innocent person in this case. I'm a taxpayer, and as such, they were all caught. Actually, 2 were on parole. 1 was on bail, but they were all caught. They are now in prison. As a taxpayer, I'm paying for their housing. I'm paying for their psychiatrists. I'm paying for their medical care. I'm paying for their families on welfare. I'm paying for their education. 1 was studying to be a lawyer. In prison, she said, I'm the innocent victim. I had staggering funeral bills, staggering medical bills. I did not receive 1 cent. Now, that is out of balance. That is not looking to the person that was the innocent victim of crime. That 37 states in 1980 had some sort of victim compensation program, but most of them were either bankrupt or offering very de minimis amounts of money. I'd just like to say, in all the things I've talked about, every state in the union now has victims of rights legislation, victims of crime compensation, and legislation and statutes dealing with every single one of the subjects that I'm talking about. And we owe that to Ed Meese and the Ed Meese Justice Department. And I think that is a tremendous, tremendous legacy. Can I have just a couple more minutes? I asked my husband if I could have a couple of more minutes. How lowering. Okay. Now, I just want to talk about a couple of more issues. One that he created as Attorney General was a task force on family violence. Now, we're talking about the early 80s. This was not like right up there with something that was popular probably in the conservative movement or in any other movement. The task force on family violence, because he realized that being beaten in your home is no less a crime than being beaten on the street. And the myths that were dispelled have helped so many families, so many children from the years since then. And some of the myths you may remember that only the poor are battered. Well, we all know that's not true. Arrest exacerbates violence. We found out, in fact, that it does not exacerbate violence. There is much less violence if somebody's arrested and held accountable right away. That incest and molest have caused no harm. Can you believe that was a very strongly held myth in the early 80s? Women enjoy violence. That used to really get me. I don't know if there's a woman here that enjoys violence. I've never met one. That it was not criminal behavior, and that the final myth is you don't interfere in family matters. All of these myths have been dispelled. Every police department in the United States now addresses this issue seriously and with concern. I think with a lot of training, all the DA's offices in the United States now have training on victims' issues, offices within their departments dealing with victims' issues. Law schools now are beginning to teach. They were the slowest to come around. It's like dragging something through. I don't know what. But they're beginning to realize that a victim is different than Bhopal. It is something that is a victim of crime and that you can talk about them without ever abridging a single right of the criminal or the accused. Also, the judicial colleges. I actually get to teach a few courses at the judicial colleges now. They're not overly popular sometimes because we judges do tend to think we know it all, but they do come, and it is a big landmark, I think, that they're being taught. Also, further, Ed Meese in the Justice Department had the Child Safety Partnership and the Pornography Commission, which also illustrated a lot of what we're hearing. In fact, it reminds me of the last story. I don't know if I ever told you this, Ed. One time I was humming a song at home, going, and she said, "Mother, do you know that's from The Prince?" I said, No, I don't know who sings it. I just thought it was a catchy tune. She said, "You want me to tell you what he's saying, Mother?" You know, the way they speak, they spoke so fast. I said, "Well, yeah, well, what's he saying?" "Well, I don't think, you know, F you and bitch and, you know, all of these things the Prince was putting to music. I hadn't even figured it out. I was just humming to the song." We were so ignorant of pornography and all the other aspects of the vulgarity that and violence. So, Ed Meese, we owe you a tremendous debt of gratitude. All of us, everybody in this room, everybody in this United States, for the courage you had, the steadfastness you had, and you and your colleagues in your department to hang in there, to keep the focus, which is so desperately needed, on protecting innocent victims of crime. So, thank you.
Thank you, Lois. Our next speaker comes from Pepperdine University, which is right over the hill, one of the finest universities in California and in the nation. And a little tidbit of information, this library was almost located at Pepperdine University, and actually it ended up here, obviously. But I'd like to introduce a professional of constitutional law, Professor Douglas Kimmick, a strong member of the Reagan administration and the Meese Justice Department. Doug?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. the reference to Over the Hill I thought was going in the wrong direction. And Judge, when I worked for the Reagan administration, I didn't meet the gray hair criteria, but something has happened dangerously since. The Office of Legal Counsel, as many of you know, has historically been known as the Attorney General's lawyer. During any political administration, that title suggests the importance of the work, but it vastly understates the honor and the privilege of working for Edwin Meese. The Edwin Meese that I knew in 1980 and that I know today is a man of uncommon wisdom and uncommon gentleness and kindness. Cicero reminds us that there is no duty more obligatory than the repayment of kindness. Mr. Attorney General, we owe you a great debt. Many of us were attracted to the Reagan administration by five words that Ronald Reagan spoke in July of 1980. Family, work, neighborhood, peace, and freedom. As Ken Cribb so ably presented, those policy perspectives were the backbone of the Reagan years, and there was no better person in the administration than Edwin Meese in translating that backbone of first principle into real results. The integrity of the family would be advanced by the recognition, as Judge Haight just referenced, that pornography denigrates and degrades a woman and a human person, by the legal arguments in favor of school choice that would enhance the fundamental value of parents to direct the upbringing of their own children, and by the simple, honest statement in litigation that the word abortion appears nowhere in the text of the Constitution. The intrinsic value of work as an extension of the human person would be the subtext of Attorney General Meese's great efforts to bolster the protection of private property, to reinvigorate the original meaning of the Takings Clause, and at the same time to remind people that there is a clause in the Constitution that governments, state governments, are not to impair the obligation of contract. For far too long before Attorney General Meese came to the scene, there was an unforgivable dichotomy between economic and civil liberty, and Edwin Meese drew upon the scholarship of the late Bernard Siegan and many others to erase that untenable distinction. The importance of neighborhood lived in the recalibration of the federal and state balance, something dearly of importance to the president, and it came down to simply two words: federalism matters. And that would be carried forward in an executive order on federalism, as well as legal argumentation that time and time again would remind the federal courts and the Supreme Court of the United States that the 10th and 11th Amendments were not merely truisms. The peace of society would be advanced by adhering to an authentic principle of equal protection and equality, the one that actually was written into the 14th Amendment, and Labor Department regulations that insidiously stirred divisions in society with unjustified set-asides and categorical preferences and quotas would be challenged by the Attorney General, yes, on the simple ground that they were immoral, they were irrational, they were illogical, but just plainly there was no grounding for them in the text of the Constitution. And freedom? Well, the Attorney General would, with unfailing tenacity, remind us that our central charge was to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Yes, laws faithfully executed. Not committee reports, not report language, not manufactured legislative history, not penumbral specters, no relationship to the senator, but the written Constitution, a written Constitution faithfully executed. a written constitution that grasps the scope of the separation of powers, that understands that legislative commerce power does have a limit, that judicial review and judicial supremacy are not one and the same things, and that appreciates those 15 words in the Constitution that vest the executive power in the United States, and that means all of the executive power. It is not fashionable in 2007 to speak of the unitary executive, but then Ed Meese knew that the drafters of the Constitution had a principle other than popular fashion that was guiding them. The unitary executive wasn't popular in 1987 either, and it gave us the constitutional hypocrisy of the independent counsel legislation that not only had the potential, but the realized actuality of criminalizing the separation of powers, even in an area as delicate as the foreign affairs. The work of the Office of Legal Counsel, of course, was not guided by popularity, and it did not have as its central charge legal policy. It had as its central charge interpretation of the law. And sometimes that would put us at odds with the President and the President's desired policy. It is OLC's calling to speak objectively and to be guided by the law as written, and not to foster the policy that one would prefer contrary to the text of the Constitution and the law. More than once, unhappily, it was our duty to report to the Attorney General and through him to the President that something the President dearly wanted as a policy matter, say a inherent line item veto, could not be undertaken within the Constitution as it was presently drafted. One will always remember President Reagan's reaction to that unhappy conclusion. Well, I suppose you did the best you could. Saying no to the President is not an easy thing, and it shouldn't be, but under the leadership of Edwin Meese, two things were true. First of all, any conclusion that we would give would be respected and rigorously examined. And second, if it proved to be logical and sound, it would also be observed and implemented. Today, the unitary executive is caricatured and targeted as some kind of alien theory, rather than an honest reflection of the Constitution's design. Somehow the words of Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 70 are forgotten. You'll remember those words. A feeble executive implies a feeble execution of the government. A feeble execution is but another phrase for a bad execution. And a government ill-executed, whatever it may be in theory, must be in practice a bad government, wrote Hamilton. Well, Edwin Meese was not about to allow this democratic republic to become a feeble republic. The Meese initiative to publish and make more substantive presidential signing statements was not a plot to subvert the government, but to vindicate it by not allowing legislative erosion of constitutional text and by promoting quite directly transparency and accountability. Again, at this very moment, signing statements and the unitary executive are being assailed. It is argued, for example, that the founders feared the legislative branch as the most dangerous branch, and since they responded to that danger by dividing up and fractionalizing the legislature, that since in the conception of some the President has become out of bounds, it is time to divide the President from those who work for him. Democratic partisans point to independent attorneys general in the several states, including this one, and we know how well that works. But nevertheless, they angle for the same thing to occur at the federal level. This is a discredited and shop-worn idea. It is indeed an old idea. It keeps coming back like a bad penny. It was suggested that the Attorney General should be separated and made independent from the rest of the Department of Justice in the 1980s. It was even suggested that the Office of Legal Counsel be made separate and independent from the Attorney General in the 1980s. Thankfully, wiser heads prevailed. And in 1993, someone who knew the Office of Legal Counsel well would respond in the pages of the Law Reviews that those concerned with the rule of law would do better to employ more precise and meaningful terminology than this notion that somehow the Attorney General or the Office of Legal Counsel should be independent of the executive branch. This commentator wrote, "Instead of independence, it is better to inquire into the soundness of OLC's legal judgments, of the principles of interpretation used in arriving at those judgments, rather than fracturing that which was intended to be unified. It is better for critics to inquire whether OLC properly assessed the significance of the text of the Constitution, of judicial precedent, and its own prior opinions. Inquire, if you will," said this commentator, "of OLC's fidelity to principled legal interpretation rather than some narrow partisan end. That's a fair inquiry, but please, please do not speak generally and amorphously of independence. That only serves to confuse and undermine the rule of law." Who was this valiant defender of the intended role of the Office of Legal Counsel as the Attorney General's lawyer? Samuel A. Alito, Jr., our colleague and deputy in the Office of Legal Counsel, who, Ed, is today an enduring part of your legacy as well. Thank you.
Excellent, Doug. I apologize for referring to Pepperdine as the university over the hill. I had to choose between the university on my left, which is silly, or the university out towards the setting sun. I took the easier one. I do have a lot of respect for Pepperdine University, and especially I like it that you're there teaching constitutional law. Well, our next speaker is Stephen Markman, Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court, who held down a very important position in the Mies Justice Department, and that is the Office of Legal Policy. Steve, if you could step up, we'd appreciate hearing from you.
Well, having been introduced last week as one of the finest justices that money could buy in Michigan, I'm very appreciative of the introduction today. My wife was introduced by the same master of ceremonies as being one of the finest ladies to walk the streets. And she was similarly perplexed by this. So thank you for the introduction, Secretary Harrington. I'm truly honored to be here this morning, as I was honored to have sat at the conference table each morning for more than 3 years with Ed Mies and his team at the Department of Justice. On countless occasions, and concerning every manner of case and controversy, I witnessed a remarkable decision maker during this time, invariably moderate in his temperament, insightful in his questioning and re-questioning, fair-minded in seeking out a range of opinions, and ultimately well-moored in the principles that he brought to bear in determining a course of action. Ed Mies demonstrated to me an approach to decision-making that I have always since sought, albeit very imperfectly, to emulate. With each passing year, it becomes increasingly apparent that Ed Mies is simply the most consequential attorney general of the modern era, and as at the pinnacle of the conservative legal movement in the United States today, is undoubtedly the most consequential former attorney general as well. One simply must recall the nature of the public debate over the role of the judiciary before Ed Mies became the Attorney General. In particular, the rhetoric of those who were opposed to the dominant legal and judicial culture of the time. What the country needed, we were told, was more law and order judges, more deferential and more restrained judges, less activist judges, more strict constructionist judges, more Republican judges. Yet none of these descriptions quite captured what the debate was truly about. None quite communicated with clarity what had been going wrong. And in retrospect, it is not surprising, as a consequence, that conservatives were constantly being frustrated and disappointed in their judicial selections and constantly on the intellectual defensive in the judicial debate. For ideas have consequences, and the language in which ideas are couched has consequences. In recrystallizing the debate over the role of the judiciary as one properly focused upon a jurisprudence of original meaning and intent, Ed Meese redefined the public debate, engaging academia, Supreme Court justices, and presidents. To this very day, it is inconceivable to me that Justice Breyer last year would have felt the need to articulate his theory of active liberty in a book which is essentially a rejoinder to Ed Meese, but for the growing intellectual appeal of originalist theory. No other attorney general in modern times has left this kind of remarkable imprint upon American constitutionalism. And of course, Ed Meese's legacy is not merely that he articulated coherent and principled standards by which the judicial role could be clearly understood, as if that was not enough, but that it was a priority of his Justice Department to place upon the federal bench those who would adhere to such standards. As Attorney General, he was responsible for the appointment of more than 225 federal district and appellate court judges. Now, while in any enterprise of this magnitude in which predictions of future behavior are necessarily involved, there will be some clinkers. I believe that with very, very few exceptions, the Meese judiciary can be defined by reference to Holmes's dogs that didn't bark. That is, Ed Meese's judiciary is perhaps best defined by what has not taken place over the past two decades. The victims of violent crime that never were because a Meese judge did not adopt an exotic analysis of the Fourth Amendment. The public institutions that never became subject to judicial supervision and management because a Meese judge understood the imperatives of the separation of powers. The new rights that never were excavated from the Constitution because a Meese judge understood the obligation to give faithful meaning to the words of the founders. The statutes that were never amended or displaced because a Meese judge recognized the primacy of institutions of representative self-government. In literally tens of thousands of cases over the past couple decades, I believe that this legacy is in evidence. And many years ago during the Reagan administration transition, I wrote an article for Harper's Magazine, I think it was, in what I call the New Loyal Opposition, in which I suggested that the federal judiciary, at least as much as the opposition Democrats in the Congress, would come to confound and obstruct the new president in his legislative and administrative initiatives. Much of that resistance, in fact, I believe occurred, particularly during the early years of the Reagan administration. What I believe eventually became a much less aggressive resistance from the judiciary toward the policy initiatives of presidents of both parties later took place, and I believe is still one more aspect of the Meese judiciary that didn't bark. Concerning the caliber of the judges appointed under the guidance of Ed Meese, Professor Sheldon Goldman, perhaps the leading scholar of the judicial selection process and no particular friend of the doctrine of original intent, wrote in American Judicature, "With few exceptions, the Reagan administration during its second term appears to have been successful in recruiting qualified individuals who share its judicial philosophy. Appointees to both the district and appeals courts have been men and women of accomplishment. If the top American Bar Association ratings are considered a rough measure of quality, these second-term appointees can be seen as surpassing the appointees of Carter, Ford, Nixon, and Johnson, and on a whole, he writes, may turn out to be the most professionally qualified group of appointees over the past two decades. With the hindsight of another two decades, I know of nothing that would suggest that Professor Goldman or Ed Meese was wrong in assessing the mettle of these men and women. Now, this achievement in transforming, in effectively transforming, one of the three branches of the national government was not serendipitous. Rather, it was a function of very specific understandings by Ed Meese concerning the judicial selection process that were systematically translated into concrete administration policy. First, his understanding that the transformation of the judiciary required more than a search for Republican lawyers or lawyers rated AV by Martindale Hubbell. Second, his understanding that the establishment of so-called merit selection panels during the previous administration in the place of presidential judgment had neither enhanced the judiciary's merits nor produced a judiciary that reflected the values of a president who had been chosen by we the people. Third, his understanding that the executive prerogative had to be asserted even against members of the president's own party in the Congress. Also, his understanding that while the bar may be viewed as a custodian of the judiciary, to the extent that they became an interested party in their own right, their preferences were entitled to no more weight than that of doctors, tool and die makers, or hardware salesmen. His understanding that judicial excellence could best be achieved and patronage pressures best resisted by establishing a proper balance between the roles of the Justice Department and the personnel at the White House. His understanding that a serious process for recruiting and screening judicial candidates must be put into place. And in fact, the Justice Department under Ed Meese had by far the most comprehensive before-since process involving a series of interviews by those who understood the premises of Ronald Reagan and Ed Meese and thoroughly reviewed the opinions of candidates under consideration. There was no litmus test except for fealty to the law. And most of all, there was Ed Meese's understanding that his Justice Department was not looking for partisans, nor for purely political conservatives, nor for those who filled ethnic or religious or racial quotas, but simply for judges who would reason from the law and the Constitution, judges who would understand the difference between saying what the law is and what the law ought to be, and judges who understood that their responsibility was not to do justice, but to do justice under law. Very distinct concepts. The movement to reshape the judiciary, sparked by Ed Meese, has continued now for two decades as a dynamic force for responsible constitutional government in a limited and traditional judicial system. It is a movement, remarkably, in which Ed Meese himself remains at the pinnacle, in which the Federalist Society, in whose development Ed Meese has been integral, has played a leading role, and in which critical roles have been played in the judicial selection offices of the two Bush administrations by members of the Meese Justice Department. And in William Rehnquist and Antonin Scalia, we have two appointees of the Meese Justice Department. In Clarence Thomas, we have a man identified and nurtured for judicial office by the Meese Justice Department. And, of course, in John Roberts and Sam Alito, we have two alumni of the Meese Justice Department, two individuals described recently by the Legal Times as the Meese Justice Department's truest products. And in Robert Bork, of course, we have a great jurist whose nomination clarified the divide over judicial selection and precipitated the recognition among tens of millions of Americans of the centrality of the contemporary judicial debate. Victor Navasky, the former editor of The Nation magazine, writes of having once proposed to George Plimpton, the great participatory journalist, that he write an article for that magazine entitled Paper Attorney General. You remember his book, The Paper Lion. This was to be an article describing what Plimpton would do if he had one day as Attorney General to repeal all of the policies of the Meese Justice Department that he could. Perhaps because Plimpton came to recognize that the real legacy of Ed Meese would require far more than a day or a week or a decade to reverse, the proposed article never appeared. But I was reminded of this article recently when I noticed another long article in the Wall Street Journal several weeks ago about a conference at the Yale Law School convened to discuss and critique an analysis prepared by the Meese Justice Department more than 20 years ago on the Constitution in the year 2000, describing the constitutional choices that would be confronted over the last two decades of the 20th century and whose resolution would determine the meaning of our Constitution in entering the new century. And I also think about a wide variety of other issues and a wide variety of other forms in which the legal conversations introduced into the mainstream by Ed Meese and his Justice Department more than two decades ago continue despite the passage of the decades. On Miranda and MAP and the search for truth in the criminal justice system, on crime victims, on executive authority, on federalism, on separation of powers and signing statements in the unitary executive, on economic liberties in the Constitution, on obscenity, on affirmative action, and on the nature of citizenship. In these areas and in more areas, no serious debate can be conducted today without, I believe, considering seriously the work of Ed Meese and his Justice Department. And so I conclude that there's simply no figure, since the very earliest days of the New Deal at least, who has headed a public body with the intellectual energy of Ed Meese's Justice Department, and no modern attorney general who has had such a sustained impact upon the development of the law and the Constitution, and who by every indicator will continue to exert such an impact. Ladies and gentlemen, Gentleman's Quarterly recently said of Ed Meese, and no, I never quite thought of him as a GQ guy either, despite the Adam Smith tie. But they said in the span of only 20 years, many of the ideas that animated Ed Meese as Attorney General have entered the American mainstream. Now, while these ideas can barely be touched upon today, perhaps the following summary will suffice for this audience. Ed Meese's Justice Department was in every way a Justice Department that was loyal to and that befitted Ronald Reagan. I can't imagine that Ed Meese would want his legacy defined any differently. Thank you very much.
Steve, that was excellent. We're very privileged to have you in Michigan. It's a tough place to be, and especially on the Supreme Court. Our last speaker, I have to say a couple of words about, because it's hard to remember in the 80s the environment in which many of the people in the Meese Justice Department worked and in other places in the federal government. There were times, and even for Ed himself, there were times that it was very, very tough to be a member of the Reagan administration. One of the toughest jobs was the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. And we had in that job William Bradford Reynolds, who is your next speaker, a man of dedication, tremendous ability, and an iron will, who is a hero to many of us for what he did and what he is still doing today and what he stands for and how he carried forward the policies of the Reagan Justice Department and the Reagan administration and the president himself. So it's a special honor for me to introduce Brad Reynolds. Brad?
John, those are very nice remarks, and I do appreciate it, especially coming from John. I'm sure a number of you realize this, but there are also, I'm sure, people in this room who don't. But the reason we're standing in this building today and the reason we're all able to come back here and honor Ronald Reagan and really relish in all that we can see in the library has in no small measure been due to the unflagging efforts of John Harrington. And so we all owe him and will for many years owe him a tremendous debt of gratitude for making this happen and allowing us all to enjoy it. So I think that you all know that. It's a real delight for me to be here with old friends and colleagues on what is a most deserving of occasions. It's hard to believe it's been 20 years. I was asked to take a look at 20 years of civil rights enforcement, and I think that it's certainly a worthwhile endeavor to do that every 20 years. The undertaking that I was assigned was to do it in 10 minutes or less, and that's a bit of a more difficult challenge. Nonetheless, and again, painting with very broad strokes, I think a quick glance back will reveal some noticeable trends that can, I believe, add helpfully to the perspective to both Bill Smith's and Ed Meese's significant contribution to equal opportunity agenda that really did undergird and sustain and still does civil rights enforcement in this country. If we start with Plessy versus Ferguson, which was all the way back in 1896, and accept for a moment that that ushered in an era of separate but equal for a sustained period of our history, indeed probably up to at least the 1964 Civil Rights Acts, which was 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education, we can get some sense of how far we've come in the last 100 years and also some sense of how painstakingly long it has taken to arrive at this point on the road to neutrality when it comes to matters of race, gender, or national origin. In political jargon, we all have heard it said that social justice, some refer to it as social progress, moves directionally back and forth, much like a pendulum swings. So it has been with respect to civil rights enforcement. The period from Plessy to Brown, and likely 10 years beyond, is marked in broad terms by under-inclusion, when skin color, gender, and ethnicity alone serve for many in society as the proxies for exclusion, denial, or deprivation. The next 20 years or so, from the civil rights enactments of 64 to the early 80s, are, by contrast, marked perhaps a bit less intensely, but certainly no less austerely, by over-inclusion, when skin color, gender, and ethnicity alone serve for many in society as the proxies for entitlement, preference, and selective advantage. Viewed from this perspective, it's fair to say as a generalization that the pendulum swing in the direction of exclusion during the earlier era more than overcompensated in the direction of inclusion thereafter. Enter President Reagan, and with him William French Smith and Ed Meese. The agenda was, most simply, bring the pendulum back to equilibrium, which on the civil rights front means, and to Reagan, Smith, and Meese meant at that time and forever, bring the needle to rest at the point of neutrality as to matters of race, gender, and national origin. Time doesn't allow me to give you a blow-by-blow accounting of the course charted, the initiatives undertaken, the setbacks encountered, and the successes ultimately achieved. I can tell you it was a great journey, undertaken by a dedicated band of soldiers led by the best and the brightest in Bill Smith and Ed Meese. And the trail blazed not only righted the civil rights ship, but left for those who followed far less clutter on the path toward a truly equal opportunity society. In summary fashion, consider this. By the early 80s, racial quotas were seen as the remedy of choice when responding to under-inclusion. As Doug Kamik alluded to, Bill Smith and Ed Meese exposed the unconstitutional underbelly of racial quotas. And by the mid-80s, the champions of quotas had reclothed themselves in the mantle of racial preferences, not so cleverly disguised as, quote, affirmative action, close quote. Affirmative action sounded kinder and gentler, but regrettably, it still continued to enlist race, gender, and heritage to dole out jobs, student admissions, and contract opportunities. Bill Smith and Ed Meese exposed the sham. A change of name cannot alone bring about a change of identity. And affirmative action preferences, even if not numerically driven, remained unmistakably constitutionally offensive and hardly affirmative. The battle moved to the Supreme Court in the latter part of the 80s, and with the cases of Croson and Adoran, affirmative action, thankfully, and by our lights triumphantly, acquired a new definition, one that allowed race to be considered only as a last resort, upon a showing of actual discrimination, and through application of what had to be a narrowly tailored remedy available only to readily identifiable victims. That, essentially, is where the civil rights enforcement stood when we surrendered the political and policy portfolios to others some 20 years ago. The point to be made, and it's a central point, is that while the journey had not yet been completed at the time of our departure, the markers laid down in the battle to regain the high ground were firm indeed. And while kicked at by some who followed, whose equal opportunity commitment was about as clear as their definition of the word is, there has been, in the 1990s and beyond, little diversion in the pendulum's continuing swing toward neutrality. Interestingly, we have seen the emergence of yet another kinder and gentler buzzword for quotas, a.k.a. affirmative action. It now stalks under the banner of diversity. But even more noteworthy, and we can attribute this to the legacy of Ed Meese as much as to anything, not only for the common sense he brought to the civil rights debate, but also the common sense he brought to selecting judges and Supreme Court justices. Diversity does not promote race or gender or ethnicity over all else. Diversity does not allow for those less qualified to leapfrog the more qualified candidates because of race, gender, or national origin. Diversity does not replace or even displace individualized consideration. And diversity off the college campus has little, if any, purchase in student assignments for grade K through 12. And I would alert you to the Seattle and Louisville cases that were argued just earlier this term in the Supreme Court, or in employment or promotion decisions, or in contract awards. So let me conclude with these very quick observations. Ed Meese laid the groundwork for change in a number of significant areas, not only while he was Attorney General, but also while he was part of Reagan's White House team in the first term. He is not old enough for us to call him the father of originalism, but he was one of its most vocal disciples to come along in many a year. And his insights awakened a nation of lawyers and judges to the wisdom of interpreting the Constitution and laws as written, not as we would have liked to see them written. He was not the architect of judicial selection, but he restored to that process the imperative of appointing judges committed to judging and unwilling to engage in political pandering or social engineering as the means to resolve difficult cases. And in the area of civil rights, he did not bring us all the way back to the equal opportunity standard demanded by our fathers in the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. But he put us solidly and irreversibly back on the right path. And while doing so, provided a principled understanding of the civil rights laws that will, I predict, continue this country on the correct constitutional path for the years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. We have time for a few brief questions, and before we start that, I want to recognize that the real Professor Mike Uhlman has arrived. He survived the L.A. freeways. Mike, would you hustle up here, please, and handle the questions? And while he's walking up here, I want to thank Gene Meyer and the staff of the Federalist Society for putting on this event. They do a great job. Gene.
You better look at
it. Yes, it's true.
No, it's not.
Hello, Lois.
My apologies to you. I've spent the past 2.5 hours on the 210 freeway, which was closed for reasons that remain a mystery. But just to show you that there is a God, while this was going on, I was thinking very dark thoughts, in which included but not limited to civil disobedience. I solemnly contemplated Dr. Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail. I examined my conscience and moved into the service lane and proceeded about a quarter of a mile when a representative of the executive branch greeted me and 4 or 5 others, and he said to me, in a hurry, I said, yes, sir. I said, I'm going up to make a speech at the Reagan Library. You are? What's going on? So I told him about the event. He said, greatest president in the history of the world. He says, this one's on him. Go drive safely. 2 4. So, thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
What's that? Yes, Ed's here. No, he's looking fine. Yes, well, I'm sorry to say there's bad news on that front. The Democrats retook Congress. Yes, sir. Nancy Pelosi. That's right, sir. Harry Reid. Chairman of House Commerce is John Dingell. Yes, sir, he consulted with Strom Thurmond's doctor. In the Senate, Joe Biden is chairman of Senate Foreign Relations. Yes, sir. Ed, he's coming back. Unlike these other characters, who, by the way, may I say, are looking, except for Lois, a bit long in the tooth, I'm a professor. This makes me an expert. I teach the presidency and separation of powers in the judiciary. Ed once defined an expert in one of his better lines as someone who worked more than 50 miles from home, came and told you what to do, but bore no responsibility whatsoever for any actions taken thereunto, and came with slides. So I am more than 50 miles from home at the moment, but I didn't come with slides, and I'm not much of an expert. What I want to say to Ed is that an event like this is like being the corpse at an Irish wake. Your presence is necessary to get things going, but you're not exactly expected to say anything. But we've remedied that. The corpse will rise from the bier this afternoon, and Ed will have a chance to field some Q's and A's, which Gail Heriot will very graciously thrust at him. You've heard a lot of substantive stuff. I had 4 or 5 hours worth of expertise in me. I'm going to spare you that. I want to say a word about Ed Meese, the man, not just Ed Meese, the lawyer. Few people have suffered more brickbats from the enemies of the Republic in his tenure in office than the man whose public service we honor today. He bore up under that with not only great grace, but superb equanimity. Among Ed's great saving graces is an absolutely irreducible geniality that under the most adverse circumstances nevertheless shines through. I used to delight in his appearances on the Sunday news shows, where an endless series of "when did you stop beating your wife" questions would be thrust at him. He would remain smiling and give a short treatise on the virtues of marriage. Absolutely infuriated the opposition, and again they went after him, and again he resisted, and again he survived. And he's here today. This day is long overdue. It's all only going to be the first, I trust, of a series of episodes that will closely examine his service, not only as Attorney General, but as a remarkable public servant generally. What he brought to the table was that rare thing you see only occasionally in politics, and that is a dedication to something larger than himself. At the end of the day, it wasn't about him. It was about the nation, about the president whose agenda he was brought to Washington to serve. He's a man of extraordinary loyalty, great generosity of spirit, great personal kindness, and above all, courage, which, as Harvey Mansfield recently wrote, has become, alas, one of the forgotten virtues, but this man is the personification of it. And Ed, I honor you. It's a pleasure to be here today. And let's all give him a hand.